Imagine you're stationed in a submarine, right? You're creaking along in the pitch black, 1,000 feet underwater. And surrounding you on all sides are, well, millions of pounds of sheer ocean pressure, just constantly trying to crush the hull inward.
Yeah, that's a terrifying thought when you really break down the physics of it.
Right, because in that moment, you aren't just trusting the thick steel plates of the ship, you're trusting the microscopic, entirely invisible seams that are actually holding those massive plates together.
Exactly. I mean, we look at thick steel and we naturally equate that sheer mass with invulnerability. Like, it's huge, so it must be safe.
Yeah, exactly.
But the structural integrity of, a massive pipeline or a cargo ship or that submarine hull, it often comes down to these literal atomic battles happening inside the welds, battles that dictate whether the metal just bends under pressure or if it violently tears itself apart.
And that invisible battleground is exactly what we're diving into today. So welcome to the deep dive. We are looking at a brilliantly dense piece of metallurgical history from 1989.
Oh, this is a great one.
It really is. It's a study from the Journal of Materials Science by Hadashia and Svensson, and it's titled The Microstructure of Submerged Arc Weld Deposits for High-Strength Steels.
Quite the mouthful.
It is, yeah. But our mission for this deep dive is to unpack how these engineers designed a high-strength weld that, well, it practically defies the normal rules of thermodynamics during its construction.
Yeah, and to really appreciate what Padacci and Svensson accomplished here, we have to look at the central paradox of metallurgy.
Hey, the trade-off.
Exactly. For those of you listening who follow material science, you probably already know that jacking up the strength of a metal almost always comes at a really steep cost to its toughness.
Because when you make steel harder, to withstand that crushing static pressure of the ocean, it inherently becomes more brittle.
Right. It's the
It's the glass bottle problem.
Yes, exactly. Explain that for the listener.
So a glass bottle is incredibly hard, right? Like you can't easily scratch it or bend it with your hands. But if you drop it on the floor, it doesn't just dent, it shatters.
Right.
So if a submarine hull is too hard and it, I don't know, bumps against an underwater reef, we really don't want it shattering like
No,
glass.
we definitely do not. And that brittleness in welding leads to a catastrophic failure that the industry calls cold cracking.
Cold cracking. Okay, so how does that happen?
Well, when you fuse two massive plates of steel together, the weld area is boiling hot, like liquid metal hot. And as it cools down to ambient temperature, the metal physically contracts.
Oh, right, because things shrink as they cool.
Exactly. And this shrinking creates immense internal stresses. It's essentially pulling the weld apart from the inside out. So if the metal is too brittle, those internal stresses alone, just the cooling down, will cause microscopic cracks to form and, rapidly spread.
Oh.
Yeah, the weld will literally tear itself apart before the ship ever even hits the water.
That's insane. So the engineers in this study were trying to solve that exact problem. They needed a weld that could hold up to insane pressure but wouldn't succumb to this cold cracking.
Right.
And the target they were aiming for was staggering. The paper notes they achieved a yield strength of around 730 megapascals.
Yeah, and just to put 730 megapascals in perspective for you, the standard structural steel that's used to build the frame of an everyday commercial skyscraper, that yields at about 250 megapascals.
Oh, wow.
So the weld they engineered here is nearly three times stronger than the steel holding up the buildings you walk into every day.
That is massive. But getting there wasn't just a matter of melting stronger metal in a pot. They were dealing with the unique nightmare of what the industry calls multi-run or multi-pass welding.
Yes.
Because in the study, they're looking at steel plates that are 60 millimeters thick.
Which is, I mean, almost 2.5 inches of solid steel. You simply cannot take a welding torch, melt the edges together in one single pass, and just walk away.
Right, the gap is too big.
Way too big. It's too much volume to fill. So, to join plates that thick, a welder has to deposit a bead of molten metal, let it set, and then deposit another layer directly on top of it. Then another, and another.
Layer by layer.
Exactly. You're slowly filling this massive canyon between the plates.
When I was reading this part of the study, trying to visualize this whole multi-pass process, it made me think of baking, of all things.
Baking. Okay, I'm intrigued.
Yeah, like imagine you're trying to bake a 50-layer cake, but instead of baking 50 individual layers in the oven and, stacking them nicely with frosting later,
Right.
you pour a layer of raw batter into a pan and bake it. Then you pull it out, pour the next layer of wet batter directly on top of the steaming hot cake, and you put the whole thing back in the oven.
Oh man, that sounds like a fast track to a ruined dessert.
Right.
Because the bottom layer is going to be subjected to the heat of the oven 50 separate times.
Exactly. It would be a total culinary disaster. By the time you get to the final layer on top, the bottom of your cake isn't even cake anymore. The heat bleeding down from every single subsequent bake would have like continuously chemically altered it.
It'd be a
It
brick.
would be a dense, charred, inedible brick.
Well, the culinary disaster is actually a nearly perfect mechanical analogy for multi-run welding.
Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely. Because every single time a new layer of boiling molten metal is deposited, the extreme thermal energy bleeds down into the cooler layers below it.
Just like the oven heat.
Right. And it acts as an unintentional and often highly destructive heat treatment. I mean, in steel, heat is the master switch. It dictates the entire microstructure of the metal.
So the paper spends a lot of time talking about carbon partitioning during these heat cycles. Let's dig into the mechanics of that. Like, what is actually happening to the atoms in our steel cake when the heat bleeds down?
Okay, so it comes down to the shape of the iron crystal lattice. When steel is superheated, the iron atoms expand and arrange themselves into a structure called austenite.
Austenite,
Yeah,
okay.
yeah. And you can think of austenite as a very spacious architectural framework. It has plenty of room inside its lattice for carbon atoms to just sit comfortably.
Like an empty stadium.
Right. But as the weld cools down, that spacious austenite structure becomes unstable. The iron atoms violently rearrange themselves into much tighter, different shapes.
And all those comfortable carbon atoms suddenly find themselves without a chair when the music stops.
Exactly, they get evicted. So as certain regions of the cooling metal transform into tighter crystal structures, they physically squeeze their carbon out into the remaining adjacent pockets of still hot austenite.
Oh, I see.
And those shrinking pools of hot austenite act like sponges. They soak up more and more rejected carbon until they're highly, highly concentrated.
Right, and then those highly concentrated pockets finally cool down to room temperature.
And that is when the villain of our story emerges.
Here we go.
Those carbon-choked pockets transform into a phase called untempered martensite. Now, untempered martensite is intensely, phenomenally hard, but because it has all that excess carbon physically wedged inside its crystal lattice, the structure is under immense internal strain. It's distorted.
Like a piece of tempered glass that's just waiting for a single scratch to explode.
Yes. It is disastrously brittle. This untempered martensite is the prime suspect for cold cracking. It creates these microscopic zones of extreme weakness scattered all throughout the structural seams of the submarine.
So the engineers are staring down this massive problem. They have to lay down layer after layer of boiling metal, knowing that the thermodynamics are just constantly threatening to bake these pockets of brittle glass right into their work.
Exactly.
So to solve this, Padeshia and Svensson first had to actually see what they were dealing with. But the study reveals that just getting a look at this metal was a massive technological hurdle all on its own.
It really was. So they created an experimental weld, which they dubbed Weld One. It was a submerged arc weld packed with a very specific, highly alloyed chemical recipe.
What was in it?
Well, they used 2.2% nickel, 1.3% manganese, and trace amounts of molybdenum and chromium. But the most crucial element was actually what they left out. They dropped the carbon content down to an incredibly low 0.1%.
Okay, now hold on. I'm going to stop you there because I think if you're listening to this at home, you might have the same genuine skepticism I did when I read that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Like, if these engineers control the vat, if they know they just poured in exactly 2.2% nickel and 0.1% carbon, why do they need to zoom in with a microscope to see what they made?
I mean, that makes sense.
Right. Chemistry is chemistry. If I mix water and flour, I don't need a microscope to know I have dough.
It's a fair question, but it fundamentally misunderstands how metals work. Chemistry is really just the ingredient list. The microstructure, like the physical architecture of how those atoms actually bond and interlock, is the actual baked cake.
Oh.
You can take two blocks of steel with the exact same chemical composition down to the atom. If you let one cool slowly in the air over 24 hours, and you take the other and plunge it into ice water while it's still glowing red hot,
You get two different things.
you get two entirely different materials. The arrangement dictates whether the metal will stop a microcrack or shatter under pressure.
So they needed to see the arrangement.
Right. And standard metallography in the welding industry usually involves just cutting a piece of the metal, polishing it, and looking at it under a standard light microscope.
Seems simple enough.
Well, when they did that with this super strong Weld One, the paper states the primary structure appeared, quote, entirely featureless.
The light microscope just couldn't see it. Like, the physical waves of visible light were literally too big to resolve the intricate atomic structures giving this metal its strength.
Yeah, they had to go significantly smaller. To reveal that hidden architecture, the researchers had to utilize transmission electron microscopy, or TEM.
And the preparation for this is just staggering to read about.
It is. They had to take solid chunks of this ultra-high-strength steel weld and mechanically grind them down into tiny disks that were 0.08 millimeters thick.
I really want you to visualize that. They are taking a material three times stronger than skyscraper steel and physically grinding it down until it is essentially the thickness of a human hair.
Yeah.
They're turning solid steel into a translucent paper film.
And that's not even the end of it. After grinding it, they electropolished those disks in an acid bath to strip away the surface atoms, making it even thinner and perfectly smooth. Only then could they put it in the TEM.
Because it needs to be transparent to the electrons, right?
Exactly. Instead of bouncing visible light off the surface of the metal, a transmission electron microscope shoots a high-voltage beam of electrons straight through that ultra-thin sample. The electrons interact with the dense atomic lattice, casting this highly detailed shadow of the internal structure onto a detector.
So they finally peel back the curtain, they look at the electron shadow, and they find the secret armor that makes this weld so incredibly tough.
They did. And interestingly, they found it by looking at what was missing.
Right.
The transmission electron microscope confirmed that their specific high alloy recipe completely suppressed the formation of detrimental, weaker crystal structures. The paper specifically names allotriomorphic ferrite and Widmann-Stettin ferrite.
Which, I mean, those sound like a mouthful, but the way they behave is fascinating.
Oh, totally.
Think of the internal structure of steel like an old medieval stone wall. You have large, solid stones, which are the steel grains, and between them you have the mortar holding them together, which are the grain boundaries.
That's a great visual. And in a standard weld, as the molten metal cools, the first structures to solidify usually start growing right in that mortar on the grain boundaries.
Where it's weakest.
Right. Allotriomorphic ferrite just loves to form along these edges, and as it grows, it links up, creating these long, continuous veins of weakness throughout the metal.
It creates a continuous fault line. Like, if the submarine hull flexes and a microscopic crack starts in that weaker ferrite, it can just zip along the mortar like a zipper.
Yeah.
It just bypasses the strong stones entirely and tears the metal in half.
Exactly. So you absolutely do not want your crystals forming in the mortar. You want to force them to grow inside the stones themselves. And the TEM revealed that is exactly what happened here.
What did they see instead?
A massive volume of the weld, between 40% and 70% of it, was made up of a heroic structure called a acicular ferrite.
A acicular ferrite. The paper describes it as forming in sheaves of lenticular plates. And when I read that description, the image that immediately sprang to mind was Kevlar.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's like taking a massive handful of shredded Kevlar fibers and just throwing them into a vat of wet concrete.
That is a brilliant way to picture intragranular nucleation. Because unlike the weak ferrite that forms on the edges, a acicular ferrite nucleates inside the grain, often attaching itself to tiny nonmetallic impurities trapped in the steel.
Oh, okay.
And it grows outward in these chaotic, interwoven, needle-like plates.
So they're completely misaligned. They point in 1,000 different directions, just overlapping and locking together.
And that misalignment is the actual key to its toughness. It acts as internal microscopic armor. If that same microcrack tries to start under the pressure of the ocean, it can't find a straight fault line to travel down anymore.
Because it's a maze.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It moves a fraction of a millimeter and immediately slams into a hard plate of a acicular ferrite.
The crack gets deflected, it tries to turn, and it hits another plate. It's like a car crashing through a dense forest.
Right.
With every single impact, it loses energy until it just physically stops. The internal armor physically catches the cracks before they can even spread.
The structural genius of this is just incredible. But the researchers went further, you know, to figure out how this happened. They analyzed ancillary welds in the study welds 2 and 3 to understand the chemical manipulation behind this.
And what did they find there?
They used trace amounts of boron, protected from the extreme heat of the welding arc by titanium.
Trace amounts. I mean, we are talking parts per million here. How does a dusting of boron dictate the entire structural integrity of a massive submarine seam?
Well, it comes down to atomic real estate. Grain boundaries. The mortar, in our stonewall analogy, are very messy, highly disorganized atomic spaces. and boron atoms happen to be the exact right physical size to fit perfectly into those messy gaps.
Like puzzle pieces.
Basically, yeah. During the cooling process, the boron atoms rapidly segregate. They migrate to the austenite grain boundaries and literally wedge themselves in.
They occupy all the available seeds.
They chemically occupy the boundaries. So when that weak, dangerous allotriomorphic ferrite tries to nucleate in the mortar, there's simply no physical room for it. The boron chemically suffocates it.
That is amazing. So the weak ferrite is locked out, which forces the cooling metal to form its crystals safely on the inside of the grains, giving us that beautiful, chaotic, acicular ferrite armor.
Yep.
It is just a brilliant hack of atomic physics.
It creates the absolute perfect microscopic armor for that single layer of weld.
Right. But this brings us right back to our 50-layer cake problem.
Oh, yeah.
Layer one is perfect. It is Kevlar-reinforced concrete. But then the welder comes back with a 2,000-degree torch to lay down layer two and layer three.
Right. The heat treatment.
They're repeatedly exposing this intricate, carefully choreographed armor to massive blasts of thermal destruction. Shouldn't that heat just, I don't know, melt the boron out of the boundaries, recook the acicular ferrite, and turn the whole thing back into brittle, untempered martensite?
Well, thermodynamics suggests it absolutely should. But this is where the paper delivers its biggest shock.
Yeah.
If you look at figure 11 in the study, they mapped the hardness of the completed multi-run weld from the top surface all the way down to the deepest bottom layer.
I spent a long time looking at that graph. The mean hardness was 288 on the Vickers hardness scale, but the astounding part was the standard deviation.
Yeah, tell them what it was.
It was just 12 HAPNI. For anyone listening who analyzes data, a standard deviation of 12 across an entire massive multi-run weld means it is virtually identical.
Completely uniform.
Top to bottom, layer to layer, the metal is completely uniform. And again, I have to play the skeptic here.
Please do.
You cannot repeatedly blast a delicate crystalline structure with a blowtorch and have it not change. How on earth did this alloy cheat the laws of thermodynamics to stay so perfectly uniform?
Well, it didn't cheat them. It weaponized them.
Okay, now you have my attention.
The engineers designed a two-part thermodynamic mechanism to create what is essentially a self-resetting metal.
Self-resetting. Let's walk through those two parts. What's the first mechanism?
The first part brings us back to that incredibly low carbon content we highlighted earlier, just 0.1% carbon. Because the overall carbon is so aggressively restricted, the small amount of martensite that inevitably forms simply doesn't have enough trapped carbon to severely distort its crystal lattice.
Ah, right. So it never becomes that highly stressed, brittle glass we talked about.
Exactly. It is remarkably temper resistant. To prove this, the researchers took the primary microstructure and literally baked it in an oven at 300 degrees Celsius for 8 straight hours.
8 hours.
And after all that thermal abuse, they found almost no detrimental changes. The heat merely caused the precipitation of extremely fine cementite particles.
And the paper notes those cementite particles were microscopic, like far too small to act as initiation points for cleavage fractures.
Yeah.
So the low carbon acts as this incredibly robust heat shield against the lower temperature bleed over. That makes sense. What is part two?
Part two is a brilliant manipulation of transformation temperatures. By heavily alloying the steel with specific elements, particularly manganese, the researchers drastically lowered what metallurgists call the AE3 temperature.
The AE3 temperature. Okay, break that down for us. What does that threshold actually represent?
You can think of it as the ultimate reset button. It is the precise temperature threshold at which the solid cooled steel crystals abandon their shape and transform all the way back into that high temperature austenite phase.
The empty stadium.
Right. In standard steel, hitting that reset button requires an enormous amount of sustained heat. But by flooding the alloy with manganese, they significantly lowered the thermal threshold required to trigger it.
So let's put it all together. The welder comes in to lay down layer number two. The boiling metal goes down, and the intense heat bleeds into the perfect acicular ferrite armor of layer number one late.
But instead of that heat just partially melting the armor and permanently leaving it in a degraded, damaged state.
Wait, it triggers the reset?
Yes. The artificially lowered A3 temperature means the bleeding heat is actually intense enough to hit the reset button. The damaged region immediately fully reaustenitizes. It reverts back to the blank slate architectural framework.
It goes completely back to square one.
Exactly. And because of the boron occupying the boundaries and the high hardenability of the manganese and nickel, as soon as the welding torch moves a few inches down the seam and that region cools down a few seconds later.
It doesn't form weak structures.
No, it recrystallizes perfectly back into that ideal interlocking armor of acicular ferrite and temper-resistant martensite.
That is mind-blowing. The heat from the construction process is actually triggering a healing cycle.
It really is.
Every time you blast it with thermal energy, instead of degrading into a charred cake bottom, it melts down to its base coat and repaints the masterpiece perfectly. It practically heals itself.
It represents a profound level of metallurgical control. Mm. I mean, they produced a multi-run weld for extreme pressure environments that remains mechanically uniform from top to bottom. It completely neutralizes the chaotic thermal environment of its own creation.
It really fundamentally changes how you view the built environment around you. Like, yeah. Creating high-strength infrastructure isn't just about melting bulk metal together until it looks solid.
Yeah.
It is about a microscopic atomic choreography. By perfectly balancing these alloys to ensure a low carbon content and a low transformation temperature, these engineers created a weld that guards against ocean-crushing pressure with internal interlocking armor. And miraculously, it effectively resets its own ideal crystalline structure under extreme heat.
And I think for you, the listener, it's a powerful reminder. You know, the next time you drive over a massive steel suspension bridge or see a heavily laden cargo ship sitting deep in the water, take a second to think about the invisible microscopic battles that were fought and won at the atomic level just to keep you safe.
That's a great point.
The true strength of those towering structures isn't in the sheer bulk of their steel, it's in the unseen intelligence of their design.
Which leaves me with a final lingering question to ponder long after we wrap up here. We just spent, 20 minutes talking about an alloy engineered to leverage the destructive heat of its own construction to effectively reset its ideal structural integrity. Could this exact same principle of low-temperature phase transformations be applied to design other futuristic materials? Could we eventually build self-healing infrastructure that actually re-optimizes its own strength the more thermal stress it undergoes?
Now, that is a thought.
Imagine a steel bridge that actually gets structurally safer the harsher the summer heat becomes. Now, that is something to think about.